Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. A word of caution. This episode of the JAX deals with the issue of suicide. Rachel Zimmerman is an award-winning journalist who has written about health and medicine for more than two decades. This year, she wrote a book titled Us After, a memoir of love and suicide. Welcome to the Exchange, Rachel.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, I can't imagine how challenging it must have been for you to write this memoir in the aftermath of your husband taking his own life, but I'm grateful that you did. You opened the book with a prologue of you and your husband celebrating your birthdays a few months apart. Tell us about him.
Beth was a devoted father to our two daughters, who were 8 and 11 years old when he died. He was a tenured robotics professor at MIT. He was close with his parents. He had an extended family who he regularly kept in touch with. His students loved him. So in other words, he had a robust social network. He was this laid-back professor. He'd often teach in shorts. He kept a bottle of bubble mix in the back of the car. So if he happened to run into a bunch of kids, he could make these huge, amazing bubbles. So he had a childlike side. But he was at MIT and he was extremely ambitious. And I think, as a friend of mine recently said after reading the book, it was like Seth had a PhD in hiding, because although he was highly functional and, you know, was in top ranks of his field and had never been diagnosed with any severe mental illness, he clearly had illness going on, deep depression, perhaps bipolar, and it got the best of him. And when his anxiety spiked, he didn't have the tools to deal with it. He had never been in long-term therapy. And again, I think he tried to hide the issues he had and the illness he had because he had such high standards for himself and he didn't want anything to get in the way.
And he was just 50 years old, and you drop a remarkable data point about the number of suicides at MIT within a short period of time.
Yes. During a 14-month period between 2014 and 2015, there were 6 students and 1 professor, my husband, who died by suicide. So that number is extremely high during that period, and things have gotten better since then. But it spoke to the intensity of the environment, and it really triggered a kind of reckoning at MIT, where they did try to make mental health services and support much more accessible to the kids. And I think people would say it's gotten better, but that's a pretty vulnerable age, right? Undergraduate, early 20s. That's when a lot of mental illness spikes and emerges. So I think MIT is certainly not the only university college campus dealing with the crisis of mental health support in kids that age.
Absolutely. You tell us about your husband's suicide in one paragraph in the opening chapter titled Widow, and the rest of the book is devoted to what happened after. As I was reading, I noticed that each chapter is a brief vignette that offers a snapshot of the scenes that you experienced and the range of your thoughts and emotions. How did you determine this was the best way to tell the story, and did your background as a journalist influence your approach to grieving?
Shortly after Seth died, I thought, wow, this is a terrible, terrible story, but it is a story because that's the way I think. I've been a reporter for more than two decades. The events of my life get metamorphized into stories. And at first, I wasn't sure exactly the form this would take. But a couple of months after he died, an MD friend of mine who had left medicine because she was so frustrated at the U.S. medical system because they no longer captured patients' stories. And with the 15-minute appointments, there was no time for patients to tell stories. So she started a nonprofit all about the therapeutic benefits of telling your story. And she asked if I wanted her to tape me. So I met with her over the course of a year, and we just had these rambling conversations about what I was going through. And I listened to those tapes about a year after we'd finished. We taped for the entire school year. And what I realized was the difference in not only the content of what I said from the beginning conversations to the end, but even the sound of my voice. At the beginning, it was raw and scratchy, and I didn't finish sentences, and I didn't finish thoughts, and my sort of meandering quality to all of the sentences was very apparent. By the end, I was calmer, more grounded, my voice was stronger, and I thought, okay, this is the narrative arc of a real possible book. And so that began a writing process, which initially, actually, the book was going to be a series of linked essays, because again, as a journalist, we're good at coming to the end of the story and sort of wrapping things up in a little tidy bow. But I had readers reviewing these essays that I thought would make up the book, and they said, this is too tidy. This story cannot be wrapped up in an essay again and again. Like, we need to feel more of what you went through. So I broke open those essays and tried to figure out with much more detail the connective tissue and the details of what I went through and what my two daughters went through.
I'm glad you did. I'm talking with Rachel Zimmerman, award-winning journalist and author of Us After, a memoir of love and suicide. You mentioned your daughters. They were preteens at the time. Talk about how you prepared to break such devastating news to them.
So the state trooper came to my door at about 11:30 a.m. to tell me the news of Seth's death. I had been racing around all morning trying to figure out where he had gone, and here came the news. My children were at day camp, and I had until 3 p.m. to figure out what to tell them before picking them up. So I did what journalists are pretty good at, which is finding an expert who knows much more than you do about a complex situation. So a journalist colleague of mine connected me with a very smart psychiatrist at Massachusetts General Hospital. She called me and I said, I need a script. I have no idea what to tell these kids. She basically said, you should tell them the truth. Don't lie. Don't give them huge numbers of details, but don't make anything up. And mostly reassure them that you are fine. You are not going anywhere. And the three of you together will go on. And that's what I did. And from there, a lot of it was about just really listening to my kids' needs and being very attuned to what they needed in the moment and over time and as they evolved and grew developmentally. So for one example, I grew up in New York, everyone was in therapy. And so I assumed this is such a devastating trauma. I thought, okay, my kids are going to go right to therapy. And my oldest daughter, who was again 11 at the time, was sort of like, okay, you want me to sit in a strange lady's office and talk about my dead father. No, thank you. So, okay, you don't have to go to therapy. That makes sense. But my younger daughter, who was 8, we went to a grief group, and she talked about how she appreciated it because she hung out with other kids. They didn't talk about loss. They did art projects and jumped on a trampoline and painted rocks. And it was really helpful to find other kids who had gone through a similar loss. So really, as they grew up, it was about listening, acknowledging that they were different developmentally, and when one might have needed something, the other might need something else. My younger daughter was really into getting the details. She's the one who first asked, tell me exactly how daddy died. Whereas my older daughter just wanted to retain her memory of Seth as he was before death, and also leaning into our community. I can't speak enough about the women in my circle who stepped up and offered to cook for me and drive my kids to gymnastics and pick up the phone in the middle of the night when I needed to cry and vent. And frankly, in our unluckiness, we were fairly lucky because Seth had left life insurance. So we were financially stable. We could stay in the same house. The kids could stay in the same school. So that stability helped ground them. My friends and our family, I was very careful to keep my relationship strong with Seth's parents, his extended family. And to this day, my kids are very close with Seth's parents and the whole Teller family.
And you found love again. How?
Well, a very close friend of mine, it was really only about a year after Seth died, asked very tentatively, do you want to meet a guy? And I was just like, oh man, I am so not ready for this. But I thought I should say yes and just see what it's like. And I met with, believe it or not, another MIT professor. He teaches chemistry, and there was chemistry between us. And when we first started seeing each other very slowly and cautiously, I really felt like I was doing something illicit, like I was betraying the vows that Seth and I had made to each other. There's this conventional wisdom about what a widow is supposed to do and how she is supposed to act. And it doesn't really involve dating. It involves like wearing black and suffering forever. And so we dated. You know, I really didn't want my kids to feel like their father had been replaced. Right. So we went very slowly. And 5 years after Seth's death, we married. And I gained a new husband and a stepdaughter. We moved into his house. He has a daughter. The three girls shared a bathroom and they call each other sisters. And I, you know, I'm not saying blended families are easy. They're complex and require work, but it did work out.
That is amazing. I've been talking with Rachel Zimmerman, award-winning journalist and author of Us After, a memoir of love and suicide. Thank you so much for joining The Exchange, Rachel.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it, and I enjoyed talking to you.
I'm Mike Green. You're listening to The Jefferson Exchange on JPR.